I was just Thursday. I had a little bit of a tire. Just wanted to say. I guess we went to like the fire brigade and
okay, we'll start with our vows. So set a good motivation before we do our vows. Okay. Is it okay, Melinda? Okay. Akiko, is it okay? Great. So, Geshe Gelson is teaching in San Jose today, and you can access him on the web. I think he teaches at... Is it 3? Yeah, 3 o'clock. So you can access it live on gitocenter.org, I believe it is. Yeah. But anyway, he said to say hello to everyone, just to catch you up on the details of things a little bit. This next weekend, we'll be having a mini retreat, the first of the mini retreats. So Saturday evening, he'll give a short talk on equanimity, and then Sunday morning we'll do the 24-hour Mahayana precepts. We'll take the precepts at 5 in the morning, and people are to have just one meal that day. So if you'd like to join us, you can come for the teachings at 7:30 Saturday night, and then come back for the 5 o'clock Mahayana precepts, and then we'll practice until 10 o'clock in the morning. Not the evening. Let's see. Also, if you want to just come to sit for a little while before the class, you're welcome to do that. If you don't want to take the precepts and just want to come and sit, that's fine as well. Also, at the end of the month, Geshe-la will be giving the Bodhisattva vows, and I called him this morning to clarify what it was or what the commitment was for people who are taking the Bodhisattva vows. And he said that he was going to give the Bodhisattva vows as an aspiring practice. So there are two types of the Bodhisattva vows. For those of you who are new, Bodhisattva is the view or the mental attitude to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings. So really looking at working on ourselves, purifying all our negativities and acquiring and accomplishing all the excellent qualities to become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings. A Buddha means someone who is awake, someone who is not driven by our delusions and other difficult mental attitudes. So he'll be giving the aspiring or the wishing bodhisattva vows. And he said, particularly in taking that vow, you make the promise not to harm others and not to hurt others and to really work for the benefit of others. Melinda, they're asking that the volume go up a little bit more, please. Okay, so is that a little better? Okay, and then also that we make merit, we accumulate merit through our practice and our actions, so that we can fulfill this wishing vow. Okay, so we'll do our prayers. Besides you, is there anyone here who this is the first time you're here? First time? Okay. Have you studied any Buddhism before?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay. Okay. Welcome. Thank you. Okay. So we'll do the refuge. Geshe-la generally does them in English, in Tibetan, but I like to do them in English when it's with us. So as you take the refuge, think of your spiritual mentors, think of the Buddha, the teacher, the teachings, and the spiritual community, and how important they are towards our practice, thinking of what we've taken refuge in the past, okay? So in other words, we've taken refuge in the past in...
Money,
food,
pride,
our bodies, rock and roll, yeah, and you know, you think about all those things we've taken refuge in, and they do bring pleasure, they bring some satisfaction, but they don't bring a lasting transformative pleasure. We do need to eat, right? We do need to have some enjoyments in our lives, but thinking about how, in fact, they aren't the things that can really help us gain liberation from suffering. Welcome. So in taking refuge in our gurus, you know, it's finding the a worthy and qualified spiritual mentor. Take refuge in the Buddha. Buddha means someone who is awake, someone who is not obscured by delusions. The Dharma are the teachings of that being, or the and then the Sangha are the spiritual community. So think about how important finding the proper refuge is. And then we'll say the refuge formula. I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. And then the Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga is called Ganden Lagema, and it incorporates the seven limb practice. It's really an excellent daily practice that one can do. So it incorporates many, many different aspects. So we'll say the first three lines. So the first three lines is first three verses. It's setting up the image. So Lama Tsongkhapa was a 14th century Tibetan Buddhist saint, And that's his statue there, along with his two main disciples, 14th century scholar, practitioner, author, meditator. So we're thinking, imagining him, really the guru is not someone we worship particularly, but turn our minds to, thinking about the qualities of how important a spiritual mentor is, and their qualities and how we can cultivate them ourselves. Okay? So we'll say the first three verses. From the heart of the Lord of the Gandhandevas emerges a brilliant white cloud, like a great mass of fresh yogurt, atop sits Tsongkhapa, all-knowing king of Dharma. We request your coming to this place along with your great disciples. My Lord Guru is seated before me on a lion throne, lotus, and moon cushion. His white face smiles blissfully. Please remain many eons and serve as a supreme merit field for the growth of my mind of faith and for the increase of Lord Buddha's teachings. Your omniscient wisdom mind encompasses all that is existent. Your speech is a profound teaching which ornaments the ear of the fortunate. Your body's beautiful radiance evokes wondrous admiration. I prostrate to you, Lama Tsongkhapa, whom merely viewing, hearing, or contemplating earns one great merit. So that third verse, is really thinking about the qualities of the teacher. And, you think about how when you find somebody who is so worthy that, their body and their speech is so appealing. You're so drawn to their presence, of really looking at their qualities and this interest to study and practice comes naturally and spontaneously in ourselves too. So the next verse is the verse of offering. So you imagine offering all the things that are precious to you. And then the verse after that is confession. So we'll do offerings. Imagine offering these things, water, flowers, incense, and generating a sense of generosity, purifying our sense of miserliness. And then the next verse of confession is thinking about negativities that we might have done, where we harmed others through our body, speech, or mind, where we hurt someone by saying negative things or gossiping about them, and then making a promise, wishing not to engage in that action again, and making a promise to really look at how to change that negativity. Oftentimes it's a habit, that we do, where we do things to particular friends or people that we have to work with all the time. So, cutting through that habit so that we generate some more positive action or mental attitude towards that. Okay, so we'll say those two verses. I present to you, supreme field of merit, Tsongkhapa, delightful offerings, pure sweet water, various flowers, fragrant incense, butter lamps, perfumes, and more, both physical and mental offerings, vast as the clouds and wide as the ocean. The unwholesome actions of body, speech, and mind I have accumulated since time without beginning, especially actions contrary to my three vows, Vinaya, Bodhisattva, Vajrayana. I regret extremely from the depths of my heart and reveal each and every such action. So if some of you took the refuge vows with Geshe-la already, then that would be, or other teachers, that would be part of the Vinaya vows. Okay? Then the next verse is rejoicing, thinking of the good qualities of our teachers and how they inspire us and turn our minds to practice and to becoming good persons. And so rejoice in that, and also think of rejoicing in the excellent qualities of your friends and people around you. You know, just doing good things that help ease suffering and difficulty in the world, even through little actions. You know, just helping someone across the street, picking up trash, you know, little things that just make our world a little better. Okay, so we'll say that verse. We totally rejoice in your magnificent achievements, my Lord. You strove for knowledge and realization, abandoned the 8 worldly concerns, and made the most meaningful use of human life with the 18 opportune conditions during these degenerate times. Okay, the next 3 verses are, requesting teachings, and then requesting the teacher to remain with us, creating the conditions to meet spiritual teachers again and again. And then the last verse is a dedication. Okay, we'll say those 3 verses. Pray, all you holy gurus, unerring in conduct, precipitate a rain of vast and profound Dharma from the billowing clouds of wisdom and compassion which fill the Dharmakaya sky, providing for the field of disciples precisely what is needed. May the Vajra body, created from the purity of clear light, free of rising and setting of cyclic existence, but visible to the ordinary viewer only in its unsubtle physical form, stay on unchanging without waning until samsara ends. May whatever virtue I have gathered here beneficially serve all sentient beings and the Buddha Dhamma, and especially may the essential teachings of the unerring master Tsongkhapa shine forever. So this next verse is like almost like a mantra, and it's talking about the qualities of Lama Tsongkhapa. So we'll recite that 3 times. Jay Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows, you are Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of inconceivable compassion, untainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of forces of demons. At your feet, famed Lozong Drapa, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. Jai Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows, you are Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of the inconceivable compassion, untainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of forces of demons. At your feet, famed Lozong Drakpa, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. Jai Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows, you are Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of inconceivable compassion, untainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of forces of demons. At your feet, famed Lozong Drakpa, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. So with the next 3 verses, then you imagine the first one, inviting the spiritual mentor to come to the crown of your head. So it's a visualization, an image made of light, very tiny. So you imagine calling the image to the crown of your head, facing in the same direction as you. So it's like enlightened consciousness on the crown of your head. And then the second verse, the image dissolves into light and then descends through your crown, and then down to your heart, and the image again appears at your heart, none different than your own enlightened potential. So when the image descends through your crown, just imagine your body just flooded with light, purifying all sickness and difficulties and confusion. And then the image again sits at your heart. And then with the third verse, we're asking the spiritual mentor to remain with us with us always. So then it's like remain steadfast. So always stay with us, you know. So that's the visualization. And we'll say the prayers. Glorious, precious root guru, please take the lotus seat at our crown, and in your kindness, please care for us. Bestow upon us the attainments of your body, speech, and mind. Glorious, precious root guru, please take the lotus seat at our hearts, and in your great kindness, care for us. Grant us your blessings for our temporal success and for the supreme attainment. Glorious, precious root guru, please take the lotus seat at our hearts, and in your great kindness remain with us. Remain steadfast until we achieve the essence of enlightenment. So just take a moment to do that visualization first. So imagine calling the guru to come to sit on your crown. Again, very tiny, made of light, dissolves into light, descends through your body, floods your body with light and nectar, purifying all difficulties, and then descends and sits at your heart, and then being steadfast and merging, not, you know, really melting with your own Buddha nature. So we'll continue. So this is the short verse on the Wisdom Sutra. Unthinkable, inexpressible, wisdom gone beyond, unborn, unceasing, space-like in essence, clearly perceived by a wisdom mind, homage to the mother of the Buddhas of the three times. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. So bring to mind any your comprehension about the nature of interdependence and the empty nature of all phenomena. We'll do the short mandala offering. Again, it's offering the universe, realizing that what we experience in our life came from karma and causes and conditions. So imagine offering that to all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, you know, without any sense of attachment or loss. You know. We'll say the offering. By the virtue of offering to you, assembly of Buddhas, visualized before me, this mandala built on a base resplendent with flowers, saffron water, and incense, adorned with Mount Meru and the four continents, as well as with the sun and moon, may all sentient beings share its effects. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamriyataya Me. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dhamma, and the highest assembly from the virtuous merit of teachings. May I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dhamma, and the highest assembly from the virtuous merit of hearing the teachings. May I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dhamma, and the highest assembly from the virtuous merit of hearing the teachings. May I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. So I wanted to have us work a little bit at transforming suffering in our lives. So looking at the suffering condition of our life and how we can transform that into the path of practice. So so we have a condition that's called true suffering. True suffering. And that is equal to the mental and physical sufferings that are produced by our contaminated actions and afflictions. Okay? So it actually includes all instances of mind and body of ordinary beings. Okay? Is anybody not ordinary here? So it includes all instances of body and mind of ordinary beings, except pure wishes, pure meditation, etc. So when you think about that classification, you know, we're just kind of in this morass of suffering. So it talks, true sufferings is also equal to the environments that are shared by beings in various cyclic existence. Okay? And so that means it's not just us, okay, but it's our environment too. And our environment is created by the potencies established by our contaminated actions and afflictions. So it's the condition of our body and mind and our environment. So, you know, you think about it. How we perceive the world is through our sense organs, right? And then what we're seeing out, so our sense organs are contaminated, and what we're perceiving out there is contaminated. It's created by our potencies of contaminated actions and afflictions. So it kind of gives you the sense of being like a fish in an ocean. You know, it's like we're living in it. We're swimming in samsara. Yeah? So it's... even though we keep searching around, you know, think of like little Nemo fishing, or looking for his dad, right? We keep looking for some kind of happiness somewhere in samsara, but because it's samsara, it's just going to turn into suffering. It's this really difficult, challenging situation of being ordinary beings in samsara. So, okay, so... you could say there are two types of true suffering, and that's internal and external. Right? So I just kind of explained that. It's our body and mind, and then it's our world. Samsara. Okay? Samsara means cyclic existence. So in the Buddhist view, it's also, you know, the fact that it's this life and time, a situation and circumstance around us. But what happens at the point of death and going on? Do we go on? Or do we finish at death? No? At the time of death, is it gone? You know, I was thinking last night and this morning about the engineer who was driving that metro train, you know, and 20 people died like that. It's like, what happens to their, well, their bodies are gone, what happens to their mental, their consciousness? You know, just finished. Or what continues? It's really quite interesting and powerful to think about, you know. And then this engineer, they say, was text messaging somebody. And he had three signs saying, you got to stop. But he was text messaging somebody. So that now they're trying to figure out when exactly he was text messaging, because somebody was receiving the messages. No, really interesting to think, okay, so death happens, but what happens to the consciousness? You know, suddenly you're in your next, you're heading towards your next life. So, yeah, interesting condition. So, they say that discouragement with suffering of misery and change, our own sense of discouragement of suffering and misery, is not sufficient to induce an aspiration to be, to attain liberation from enlightenment. So even if we, yeah, we just think, oh my gosh, this place is suffering. This isn't so great. They say that is not enough of a compulsion to attain liberation from enlightenment. You've got so much more to do than just say, boy, this place is really not so great. Yeah. Because otherwise then we just keep looking for the next happiness within samsara, yeah, swimming in samsara. So this third aspect of suffering is called pervasive suffering. Does someone want to share what the three sufferings are? Okay, Memila.
Suffering of suffering, which you said already.
Suffering of suffering.
And then the suffering of change.
Okay, suffering of suffering is what?
Suffering,
give an example.
Gross
overt suffering, pain, hand in the fire suffering, okay?
Okay, so suffering of change.
Suffering of change.
And then the basic suffering.
Okay, can you give an example of suffering of change?
Yes. A lot of things, like some people like to go to the beach and they always, oh, so great going to the beach and the sun is nice and everything, get very hot. Now you have to go into the water to cool off. Then it gets too cold and you get out of the water to be warm again. You think you're really enjoying yourself going from one stage to another, but it's not. It's because you're suffering, so you're jumping out of the water and going to the beach and back and forth. Same thing with our food. Some people, we eat a lot because we're very hungry, and we eat too much. Then you're suffering. So it's like that. Yeah. So there's a lot of things like that.
Okay, so Mamie gave the example of suffering of change being like going to the beach where you work on your tan and then you jump in the water because you're too hot and then you have to get out of the water because it's too cold, and on and on, and the other example about food. So I think we've all experienced the food one. we have to be really careful with that one because, yeah, you know, the condition of that change of suffering is that if it were inherently pleasurable, then the more you had it, the more pleasure you would get. Yeah, the more you ate, the more pleasure you would get. You would get happier and happier until you exploded, right? And just go into bliss. change of suffering is something pleasurable than shifting into unhappiness. Okay, so that's change of suffering. And then pervasive suffering, maybe do you have a... example of that?
Just by being born as a human being, we have the because something like our skin is so tender, if something touches it that burns it or scrapes it, or even, it's not the thing that's doing it to us, it's our body reacting to it because we have all these nervous systems and so forth, and that's pervasive, like the heat of a hot day or a cold of a day, those are all things that, because our bodies can't handle it.
Okay, so pervasive suffering is just the condition of our environment and existence. So, yeah. Thank you, Manila. Okay, so so this third suffering is called compositional, and it's also called pervasive. Pervasive, like I was saying, you know, Nemo swimming in the ocean, it's like everywhere. It's inside, outside, it's our environment, it's everything. Yeah, but it's also creating more suffering because of our misperception and misunderstanding about how, because we're driven by our afflictions and our misunderstandings and our delusions, then we keep creating more samsara. We keep creating more difficulties and challenges in our life. So we keep perpetuating this cyclic existence in our lives. So, so in fact, they say that the situation of our body and mind really is miserable. Okay? Like our teachers say, when we're young and healthy and beautiful, then we have a more pleasure with our bodies, yeah? But then when we're getting old and sick and difficulties happen, then we have a lot of suffering with our body. So even though we might have a lot of pleasure with our body initially, you know, it's this condition that's, it's like the Metrolink train, you know, where are we headed? You know where we're headed. And if we're lucky, if we're good, you know, we have a long life. But you know what long life brings is old age, sickness, and you know, whether we're healthy, young, old, or what, we all face death. So it's, you know, looking very honestly at the condition of this life. So when we look at it, then it gives us this sense of, oh, I should not just be satisfied and relax here. No, you look at how strong your mind and body is right now. This is your time to practice and really turn your mind and really think about the condition of our existence. And this is where you begin to develop the sense of renunciation and comprehension that it's not so great here. Yeah? It's like you work so hard all your life, you know, you build your family, you build your home, you build your relationships and your empire and your reputation and everything, and then you retire and you get old and you get sick and you die. You know, it's like, so when is there any good time to say, I'm going to develop my renunciation, because, you know, it's not really great any time of the way, actually. When you're a kid, you know, you're rushing to grow up, and then when you graduate from school, you're going, okay, now I have to hurry up and create my more pleasure and happiness. I don't have school anymore, so I'm going to create more happiness and pleasure. But then you realize, you know, that everything you touch is also subject to impermanence and change. You know, that gorgeous person that you just met, in fact, has all kinds of problems too, right? And that they're also subject to change and old age and sickness and death. So it's helping us to look at developing renunciation, that even though, and we need, and pleasure in our life gives us energy, gives us happiness, gives us satisfaction, it's great. However, you know, don't be satisfied with that as the end point, because it's not going to stay there. It's going to continually shift and change. So utilize that happiness and leisure, that happiness and leisure that you have, the time to practice and consider the Dharma, consider spiritual practice. I'm sorry? Oh, okay. Does someone know how to operate that? Because turn it down. It needs to be turned on, and you need to change the. Yeah, Melinda, it has to go off from the heat because first heat goes on. Thank you, Mimila. Okay. So, you know, this sense of developing renunciation so that we begin to look at what opportunities do we have in our life. You know, these situations of suffering in our life then are like wake-up calls for us to change and say, don't be reticent and satisfied with what you have. You know, look at that to really utilize your life to become a better person, to develop the view, to understand the nature of our phenomena and environment so that you can attain liberation and enlightenment and be able to work and help others. You know, not just that, you know, getting the new car, the new spouse, and the new career is the cat's meow, you know, that's not it, okay? Because, again, those are all changing, and so it's looking at how they're all part of true suffering too. All of those things are part of true suffering. And the thing is, you know, like the Dalai Lama says, if there is no liberation possible, if there is no enlightenment possible, then don't study about how things are suffering. Yeah. If there's no exit, if there's no possibility of liberation, then enjoy your life and don't think about suffering or trying to remove our delusions. Yeah, he said, live it up. Yeah, but he said, if it's possible for us to attain liberation and enlightenment, then we should find the way to do that. How do we do it? What is the avenue, and how can we attain it? Okay, so in this way, then, you know, it's looking at understanding suffering and the suffering nature of existence so that we develop renunciation. And again, you know, remember that renunciation is not austerity and denial. Renunciation is a view, right? A renunciation is a view saying, yeah, there's pleasure and suffering in the world, but it's looking at its quality so that you can keep working on your comprehension of how do I attain this path. How do I accomplish the path to enlightenment? Yeah. Because renunciation, again, in the Tibetan word means nejung, which means definite emergence. It means that your mind and your view is emerging out of samsara. It's leaving your satisfaction and your settled reticence in life and samsara. It emerging out of samsara. Okay. Yeah.
I was wondering when a good time is for questions.
Do you have a question right now? Yeah, okay. I'll ask for questions at the end. So what I'd like you to do is just to sit quietly for a few minutes. Let's do like 4 or 5 minutes and think about suffering in your own life. Okay, so Mimi clarified the 3 kinds of suffering, and you might look at examples in each of those categories. Where do you have overt suffering? You know, some like physical health ailment or some physical problem, particularly change of suffering, how you keep running after sees candies, but it gives you pimples, you know. So look at something that, how it's pleasure that changes into suffering, you know, because you keep running after that, thinking it's going to give you happiness, and then pervasive suffering, that it's this condition of our existence. Okay, so look at that in your own experience, your own examples. So in looking at suffering in our lives, yeah, and how can we transform that into the path of enlightenment, you know, the fact that we all experience suffering, that nobody is different. You know, we're all in this condition. I'm taking some of these points from a teaching by Jigme Tenpe Nyima, and he was, I don't have the dates on him, but anyway, that was the teacher who gave this teaching. And so the first one, he says, through relative truth, it's when harmed by others, we have a habit of perceiving only suffering. So even when the smallest problem comes up, it causes pain to our minds. You know? So it's looking at the mental attitudes we have about this when suffering comes up in our lives. You know, it's like when somebody's harassing us or disturbing us, even the smallest thing, and it's like we're just really afflicted by what occurs. Yeah. And then another is the nature of any perception or idea is to grow stronger by being repeated. So, you know, it's like you think about somebody causing some difficulty or problem for you, and then you repeat it in your mind, and you replay, it's like instant replay again and again and again. And it's like you just live it, and you just fire up all this upset and disgust and concern about what that person did to you, and you're just focusing in on the harm or what they said or what they did to you, and you stop looking at any other aspect about what happened, and you're just fanning the fire of upset and suffering and difficulty and how they did it to you. And so your mind is not peaceful, and you're not really present anymore. It's like you think about that person, or you see that person, and you're instantly upset, you know? So it's, and, you know, that person may have even been totally oblivious of what they did to you, no? And yet we hang on to what happened. So to look at how important communication is, and speaking up in a nice way to clarify and clear the air and things. Let's see. And then he says, if you don't recognize that it all depends on the way your mind develops that habit, and you put the blame on external objects and situations alone, then the flames of suffering, your negative karma and aggression will continue to spread. Okay? Then you're just walking around upset and angry and hurt by something that happened, you know, a day ago, a year ago, 10 years ago. So look at how, you know, it's like we grasp onto something that's no longer there anymore. So it's important for us to look at how, you know, the whole reason why sentient beings are plagued by suffering is because of this weakness in discriminating awareness. Again, discriminating awareness. For those of us who were in the meditation class this morning, you know, looking at how we work with the meditation, is you keep bringing your mind back to the object of meditation. But what happens is, you know, we tend to get caught up in a particular situation that occurred, and we replay it again and again. So rather than having our mind be buoyant and on something positive and powerful and potent, you know, we let our mind just drop right into the trough of upset. Okay? So looking at how you can change that. So we have to see, you know, in shifting this suffering into the path of enlightenment, how do we keep working to look at how we won't be hurt by obstacles, okay? So another aspect of transforming this into the path is that we need to get rid of the attitude of not wanting ourselves alone not to suffer. That I don't want to suffer. And, you know, it's like having it being such a powerful focal point that you ignore and are oblivious about other people's conditions and circumstances. So when you begin to turn that out and see that everybody's in that situation too, then your path of practice expands. You know, you can embrace other people's situation and circumstance. You know, you realize that it's not just me swimming in this samsara, but everybody is. You know, everybody's got facing this difficulty. So it says, see the uselessness and pain regarding suffering as purely harmful and undesirable. That's a really powerful one. You know, when we look at and see how suffering can be a tool for us to wake up. You know, if everything was always pleasant, we would be totally happy and satisfied here. It's like we wouldn't want to move from our favorite television show and the couch or whatever it is that keeps us into this place of gravity. You know? So the pain and suffering, you know, in our lives can be turned into a tool of practice. So when I was in Colorado, one of the Vipassana teachers was sharing a story about how this one woman from Mexico was the number two skydiver. I don't know if it was for Mexico or for the world. Anyway, she was number two skydiver. And, you know, she enjoyed a lot of fame and enjoyed this work. And one day her parachute didn't open. And she spent 4.5 years in the hospital. And she became a quadriplegic? Is that what it is? She was paralyzed from her neck down, except that she could slightly move the pointer finger of her right hand. That was it. So then, you know, it's like her husband left her. Her kids had to be raised by somebody else. And she said for 4.5 years, she was in the hospital bed just seething angry. Angry, angry, angry. All the time angry. And then they were able to rig up a monitor so that by some movements in her throat, she could speak, you know, onto some monitor. So then she started attending these Vipassana meditation courses, and one day after a meditation retreat, you know, she managed to tell Terry Ray, who was the Vipassana teacher, that after the retreat, that in fact, she would not trade for an instant who she was now for who she was before the accident. No. And looking at the situation of losing your physical capacity to move anymore for the rest of your life, yet it was her mind that changed, you know, to say, I'm so much better now, where I am now, than when I was a famous parachutist. You know? So looking again in your own life and how we drag around, you know, we have these balls and chains with us going, it's like I'm suffering from this, I'm suffering from that, I've got this problem, this difficulty, you know, and we go around so burdened by our problems and the way we hold things, you know, and he said this, and, you know, my mother did this to me, and we're it's like we're the wounded ones walking around. So to look at how we can really switch that and reject the attitude that our pain and suffering is useless, you know, to see how we can transform that. Are people starting to freeze now? It's 75.
Because this one is right.
This is the change of suffering. Okay. It's right now at 77. Okay. Okay. So it says, if you don't become anxious, then the strength of your mind will make you stronger and you'll be able to endure even the hardest suffering. You know, so really looking at that situation of the suffering in your own life and how you can transform that. Okay, so other ways than looking at using suffering to train in developing more renunciation about our condition in life. Using suffering to train in taking refuge. Okay? So remember we started by saying how we took refuge in all kinds of other things before, right? So a lot of times what brings us to meditation or spiritual practice is this comprehension and understanding that there's got to be more to life here. There's something more that I need to understand and learn so that I can use my life well. And so, you know, this for many, it's because there's been some challenge or difficulty that's saying, oh, okay, how can I relieve the suffering? You know, this pervasive. Another thing about pervasive suffering, I was thinking about that this morning, you know, and I'm realizing it now that I'm getting older, you know, because I keep thinking it's different, but this pervasive suffering is kind of like an old habitual pattern or circumstance that keeps arising, and it manifests in a different costume every time, but it's the same thing, you know? And how teachers often say that it's like we all have attachment, greed, hatred, anger, and confusion, ignorance. But with each of us, we tend to specialize in one or another. So it's important to look at what your specialty is, you know? Which one is your kind of dominance, the one that you hang out in the most, which tends to be your pervasive situation, and how from the time you were in grammar school to high school to you know, being with your friends, being in your career, being with developing your family or whatever, this, it's like that same dominant condition keeps coming up again and again, and how you operate with it, you know, you operate with greed and acquisition and attachment, how, you know, certain things come up and you don't want to let it go and you want it to keep it always the same, and it just runs right through your hands because you can't keep it that way and it doesn't stay that way. Yeah, or else you have situations, a disturbing situation comes and you just get really agitated and aggressive and angry and full of hate or something like that comes up, you know, and look at what is the one that comes up for you, you know? This confusion, ignorance one is, you know, circumstance arise and you just kind of do this deer in the headlights effect, or you just get paralyzed in some way, or you just go into real confusion, and then you can't function very well. Okay, so it's really looking at how one of these is our dominant way, even though we have got all of them. Right? And it's another reason why we need to look at purifying our negativities and delusions and cultivating positive characteristics and positive modes of action, tracks of how we operate, so that we can counteract those negativities, so that we can operate and function better, that we can be more high functioning in our life and be a little more pleasant around people, right? that people say, oh, here comes Tenzin again. You know, it's like, that's the way she always is, you know, or a situation arises and you go, oh no, I know how Tenzin's going to react to this one, you know. And you see, it's like we have this pattern of action, and so that's the one. Our pervasive suffering is a real one that, you know, that's our real enemy, but it's also our real teacher. Because that's the one that's going to help us say, oh yeah, there it comes again, and that's the one I've got to work on again and again and again. So, you know, look at that. Do people recognize that in your own life, this pattern from, I mean, whether you were 6 years old to 16 years old to 60 years old, you know, it's like, oh yeah, there it is again, right? So, you know, we all keep thinking that life is great and we're constantly changing. Yeah, we're constantly changing, but those patterns are really stuck, you know, they hang in there a lot. Okay, so it's important for us to look at how we can use our suffering to apply the practices, you know, so that we can begin to remove their strong, sticky, pervasive effects of this constant way of acting. And, you know, that's where, you know, you think about how our karma and our karmic view and the way we operate becomes so pervasive too, because, you know, it's this pattern. And pervasive suffering, you know, they're saying that it's not only this condition, but we keep creating the conditions for it to be perpetuated because of our delusions. We keep, you know, reinforcing that world and phenomena around us. So, no, it's, okay, so it says, we need to use our suffering to find joy and positive action. Yeah, that positive, virtuous actions then are really powerful counterpoints to begin to purify those patterns, to purify the suffering. Yeah, because the suffering comes up and we keep blaming it on, you know, our spouse or our friend or our workplace or our job or something else, but looking at how, you know, it's what's the common denominator here? Yeah, the common denominator is myself, yeah? And then the common denominator in those mental attitudes is our mind and the way we hold things. Yeah, and it doesn't mean passivity. It doesn't mean non-action. It means how can we correct and counter those difficulties and those unpleasant situations so that they can be transformed too. You know, realizing that samsara is impermanent, is the nature of suffering, and that, you know, we have to just keep applying. Don't think that, okay, now I found the perfect person and now my life is great, and then you can become a couch potato. Okay, it's not static. It's something that you have to continually work on. Okay. So then, then we use suffering to train in compassion, realizing that everybody's stuck in this situation, and also to use the suffering for our meditation and realize that other beings, you know, how other beings are so precious and important to us, because in fact they are like our teachers, showing us the challenge and difficulty in our lives. Okay, so you had a question? I'll open it up to questions.
One thing that's hard for me to understand is how you mentioned that just because we have renunciation if we choose, it doesn't mean we have to become, I don't remember how you said it, but someone who then relinquishes all pleasures of the world, right? But, so I understand that. I want to have renunciation.
Okay. So the question is about renunciation and how just a sense of dissatisfaction isn't going to really create and cause the deep and pure, solid renunciation, right? The real liberation. It's not going to lead to liberation. Just the dissatisfaction is not going to lead to liberation.
Well, that's an interesting question too, but
I think it was more when you were talking about austerity and how just leading a very austere life isn't renunciation.
I see what you're saying. I mean, see, here's where I am. I have these pleasures in my life.
I have pleasures in my life. It's for the benefit of the other audience.
Well, I go for these things for my pleasure, you know. I can go through the examples. I'm sure we all have those things in our life we go to for.
You go to things for pleasure?
Sure.
Okay.
But at the same time, I understand the importance of recognizing the fundamental nature of this world, that those things that give us pleasure are impermanent, etc. So I have the motivation for renunciation. However, where I'm trying to go is, I understand that just because we have renunciation, we don't become somebody used the word though.
Austere.
Austerity, yeah. So what I'm wondering is, it seems to me that to the extent I partake of my pleasures, I'm wondering if I am somehow continuing to create the conditions for my own suffering, and that it's, I think it might be a challenge to enjoy your pleasures without somehow suffering the flip side of the pleasure.
Perpetuating the suffering.
Yeah, like music. We like music, we like good food, etc.
Right.
But like one time, I went on a short-term retreat.
Okay, let me catch up the people on the internet. Okay, so the question is, or the situation and circumstance is that he goes for pleasures, but he understands the nature of that they are impermanent and the cause of change and eventual suffering. Okay, and so then?
So then, I'm a little bit confused as to why I should not become, as we would say, completely austere. And okay, it's hard to say, but here, okay, let me put it in this question. If I am to renounce world pleasures,
okay. Worldly pleasures,
then should I then become austere in that?
Should I become austere
in the way that so that I should not go for very tasty food and not, you know, go to the store and buy music that I really like, and then when I put the headphones on, I'm going to really get it.
So instead of buying really good food and really good music, you would buy mediocre food and mediocre music?
Well, I know that. Well, I'm wondering if it's necessary for me to you know, like just holy bread with no peanut butter on it.
Just have bread with no peanut butter?
Yeah, because I love peanut butter. No, believe me.
Why don't you just go for the peanut butter?
Well, I'm trying. It it's hard to express, but it seems that to the extent I pursue my pleasures, I'm also creating the
community. Okay, yeah, the real question that you're saying, I think, is that as we pursue our pleasures, aren't we creating more, perpetuating more suffering and cyclic existence and perpetuating the delusion?
Or failing to release your attachment.
Or failing to reduce the attachment?
Not being able to
let go. How can you enjoy your pleasure without perpetuating the attachment?
I want to enjoy the benefits of renunciation, but at the same time, I will admit.
I want to enjoy the benefits of renunciation, but...
Well, but I still find that I'm somewhat still attached to music I really like. And when I listen to this music... I mean, I put myself in La La Land. It sends you. It's a fantastic. It sends me. That's right. So, I want both, but I'm not sure whether I should have to take one over the other or.
You mean take your music but renounce your peanut butter?
No. Take the music but somehow. I don't. Can anybody here agree with me? I mean, I don't know whether I'm not just on.
Okay. I'm back here.
You didn't have enough suffering. So wait.
Okay.
You had a question.
Okay.
You haven't suffered enough.
Yes. Yeah. Sun Sanim, the Korean master that lived in downtown LA for a long time. You know, he'd go do these meditation retreats and then you'd take a break and he goes, more suffering needed. Yeah. Oh, hang on a second.
When I listen to the question, and very often when I come here to the class, I come to the conclusion that the only way to bring all this together, to bring all the things that I hear together, is to become a monk. And very often I'm lost as to how can I apply everything I learn by living in the world and not taking the robe.
Yeah. How can I live in the world without taking the robe? And it seems like when I come to the teachings that unless I take the robe, I can't really practice well. Is that right?
Like a logical conclusion.
That seems like the logical conclusion. Okay, I've been a nun for 23 years. That's not it. It's like the austerity of no peanut butter or what, you know. It's like the Buddha taught the middle way, you know. He lived for 6 years on one sesame seed before he found the middle way in his practice, you know. It's like there are still, even today, many practices about austerity being the path to liberation and enlightenment and clarity of mind. You know, it's really much more about moderation because you can practice austerities, but what you get is, you know, a lot of times more anger, more illness, more separation from everything else. And your mind can become very, in Tibetan they call it puzutopo, where you just become really uptight, you know. And it's not about becoming so tight and tense that you lose the essence of the path. And that's why, you know, they talk about how we have the perfect human rebirth. We have this life where we can see, you can see and observe and experience this mixture of happiness and suffering in our lives. We actually experience happiness and suffering in our lives. We can project and infer that because all my ancestors have passed on, that I'm going to pass on too. You know, that's where I'm headed. And that, you know, how do you live given the fact that it's going to finish, you know? what happens with this life and how do you live it? And it you know, there's a book that Nagarjuna composed, you know, this advice for the king, because there was a king in India who really felt that he could benefit others more by remaining a king and benefiting his people rather than renouncing and becoming a monk. And, you know, the classic view of what a monk is really removing yourself from the world, you know. And it's a very different view of how to practice in the West, because I really liked that idea and practice for a long time. You know, I love to go into long retreats and live a very austere life. You know, I was probably 40 pounds lighter than I am now. You know, it's like, I love that austerity. But, yeah, you can get high from being austere too, you know? But this whole thing about how are you really working and benefiting others? And what is your right livelihood, right action in your life? And so it's a challenge because, you know, everybody's path and wish and talents are different. And so it's how do you find that? And Geshe-la is saying, and the Bodhisattva vow and promises that he's giving you next at the end of the month if you want to take it, he's saying, don't harm others. That's your promise. Don't harm others and don't harm yourself either. And you know, for some of us, that's more important because that's our particular thing that we have to work on, is especially not to harm ourselves, you know? And so it's like, what's the right balance in that? It doesn't mean everybody has to go run off and be a monk in the forest. And, you know, it's like how to do that. So, you know, Nagarjuna spoke to this king and gave him some advice on how to work and conduct himself. It's like, enjoy your 400 queens. You know? But don't be attached to them. Realize that they're going to get old and sick and die too, you know? And, you know, think about the bills that come along with having 400 wives. You know? It's like looking at the reality of the condition of our life, you know? So it's, you know, each person has their own middle way is what I'm seeing too. Each person has their own middle way. And for us to say, you're doing it wrong, is very narrow again. Very narrow to say you're not doing it, you're not practicing middle way. And sometimes, you know, monastics can really be harsh on each other. And Buddhist practitioners can be harsh on each other. Buddhist traditions can be harsh on each other. No? They're not practicing middle way. Yeah, that's like, you know, we were practicing the mandala mudra and stuff, and Francis came up with the mudra of, you know, going like this. It's not only, you know, it's not me, but it's everybody else, but it's also pass the buck mudra, you know. It's like, who's going to do it? Yeah. So to really, it's everybody's personal challenge. You know when the music sends you, but if you listen to it 20 times in a row, your ears hurt. So, and then, you know, you forget to do everything else. So what's the middle way with that? Enjoying the music and the peanut butter, but, you know, not overdoing it either way. So it's the middle way between austerity and overindulgence. And I think you know when it happens for each of you. Each of us has a different need, you know. And it's not about being harsh and dry and really hard on yourselves. And it's not about being indulgent and totally narcissistic. You know, it's like, what's the middle way? And particularly with the Bodhisattva vow, not harming others, is how do we express that in our relationships with everyone else around? Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to answer what he says, in particular, because like music, maybe it's fine, but if you don't, something happens to your ears, you're going to really suffer, because now you're attached to the music you loved before, and now you can't have it. Just like this person that, you know, had a guy diving, she changed her mind, so she's okay. But if she didn't, she hated all that time. Same thing with your peanut butter and so forth. What if you eat it and it poisons you? You're allergic to it. No, you can't have it. But your mind is attached. So you always do what Angela was saying, it's our mind. You have to train your mind not to be attached. You can enjoy it now. But if you can't have it, you don't want to have this real suffering. So that's a control that we have.
Mindful consumption.
You don't have to be enough or yeah. The layperson. It's just the way your mind perceives things so that you're not attached. You can enjoy it, but you can let it go. If you can't let it go, then you
right.
have something.
So Mamie's clarifying the question a little bit. So, you know, okay.
One more. I'm sorry. But sometimes isn't it better to separate yourself from your objects of strong attachment? I mean,
sometimes is it better to just suffer through?
To separate yourself.
Separate. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If you have objects of strong attachment, sometimes it is good to separate yourself from it. You know, again, you can begin to see where it's being harsh or beneficial in that. You know, it's like one of the first persons I met, I worked with in hospice, and I shared this story before, but that one man who was passing away and everything was really good in the settlement of everything. And he said, my daughters are fine. I've had good discussions with them. Everything's good. And he said, I feel guilty about one thing. And I said, oh, you don't want to go with feeling guilty about something. And he said, I just feel guilty because I really am attached to dancing the hustle. I was really getting good at it. And I thought, wow, if that's all he's clinging to, you know, it's really amazing. So anyway, let's just sit for about 3 minutes and really, again, think again about what you were working on earlier on the object of suffering and see if it's shifted at all, that you can get a little perspective on it, you know, how you can transform that suffering into the path by taking refuge, looking at it as not something that you're just trying to run away from constantly, but how you can see it as something that is giving you an opportunity to wake up in your life. Okay? So pleasure is really important in our lives too. Pleasure and happiness give us energy, give us joy, give us happiness, give us so many things, and it helps us be more buoyant in our lives. And so pleasure and happiness are really key and powerful things. You know, we need our friends and we need to relax and enjoy them and our pleasures in life too. Because then with a relaxed and happy mind, we can enter and engage in all kinds of other activities with a much better attitude. So it's not about rejecting our pleasures either. It's just watching the attachment and the overindulgence. Okay? So enjoy your music and your peanut butter. Okay, so we'll do our dedication. Because of these merits, may we quickly become Guru Lord Buddha and lead each and every sentient being into his enlightened realm. May the precious bodhicitta that has not yet been received be received, and may that which has been received be increased and not decreased. May the precious view of emptiness, shunyata, that has not been received be received, and may that which has been received be increased and not decreased. By the virtue of offering to you assembly of Buddhas dedicated, this mandala built on a base resplendent with flowers, saffron water, and incense, adorned with Mount Meru and four continents, as well as with the sun and moon, may all sentient beings share its effects. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamniya Tayami. In the land of snowy mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. Lord Chenrezi Tenzin Gyatso, may you stay until samsara ends. See, so this dedication of merits is like the pure wishes. Remember, I said that everything, mental and physical aggregates, including our environments, are all part of samsara, and it's all instances of true suffering, except pure wishes. So our dedication and our prayers can be like pure wishes. You know, and they say that's out of samsara, and that's why Geshe Lao keeps saying too. You know, it's like, it, you're locking it, you're taking a key and locking it, because virtuous actions result in happiness, but when you really dedicate it to spiritual enlightenment or these kind of things, it becomes a very, very pure wish. Then he says, you know, then that's out of true suffering. Okay, so stand and do our bows.